From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Edward Hardin joined the U.S. Army in the summer of 1917 when he was 24 years old. Despite getting expelled from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill for fraternity pranks that involved laxative-laced hot dogs and cows inside buildings, the native Wilmingtonian earns his undergraduate degree in pharmaceutical chemistry and a graduate degree in pharmacy by 1914. Both before and after World War I, Edward is a practicing pharmacist at his family's business, Hardin Pharmacy. He spends 8 months in training camp at Camp Sevier, South Carolina, during a brutal winter in 1917, also winds up quarantined on Measles Hill. Finally, he ships out as Lieutenant Hardin to Calais, France, in the spring of 1918. He fights in the trenches during the Third Battle of Ypres, Belgium, and they assault the Hindenburg Line, a German underground tunnel system for moving troops, tanks, and supplies. One of his friends dies in his arms. The gore and death to which he is exposed enters the narrative in his letters home. He's injured in late October of 1918 and heads to a hospital in France. He recovers, returns to duty November 8th, and the armistice is signed 3 days later. As the centennial of World War I approaches, the letters Edward Hardin wrote to his family become our portal into his experience. More than 150 letters chronicle his metamorphosis from an educated but sheltered young man into a person who becomes intimate with killing, death, and ruin. His grandson, Edward Hardin Hoffield, who has compiled and transcribed all of those letters, joins us now. Ed Hoffield, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good to have you here.
Thank you.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation as we approach the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. Do you have stories your great-grandparents or grandparents left behind? How did they do it? What do you think we're in danger of forgetting about World War I? Call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Ed Hoffield, you have talked about World War I as something of a forgotten war, and yet it's frequently referred to as the Great War. Why do you think of it as forgotten, and why did this project become so important to you?
Well, it started about 25 years ago when my mother handed me three huge shoeboxes full of letters from World War I from my grandfather, which she had never read. And I took those when I retired 10 years ago, transcribed them, and finally got them into a Word document that she could finally read for the first time.
So you were initially doing this for your mother.
Exactly, exactly, because I wanted her to be able to read these in an order that she understood what was going on in his life from the start of training camp to his trench warfare in Germany and Belgium and finally his return home. And interestingly, she had never read those letters until they were transcribed and put into a format that she could work through chronologically day by day. And her comment was, it was amazing to me to understand a little better what this 24-year-old bachelor was going through in these formative years of his life.
Why do you think that we're in danger of forgetting World War I?
I think there's so much more history that is available to us today for Vietnam, for World War II. And even the Korean War. I think World War I, for whatever reason, and I don't understand why, really has not gotten a lot of play. Maybe it was because we don't have a lot of the information that we are so readily available today. But these letters certainly brought back to life what it was like to be in the Army 100 years ago in trench warfare.
And so for you, this wasn't just a portal into the experience of a World War I soldier. This is also in going into the experience of your grandfather. How did you think and feel about your grandfather before you transcribed his letters versus afterwards?
I knew that he was a bad boy. I knew that he put chewing gum in St. James Episcopal Church, Oregon. I knew he put Limburger cheese in the heating system. I did understand that he was—
At St. James Episcopal Church?
Yes, he
here
did.
In downtown Wilmington?
Yes, ma'am.
And he put Limburger cheese in the heating system.
He did.
That's
that was the family's family lore, but I wasn't here, so I can't prove it. But when he got kicked out of the University of North Carolina for his fraternity prank and ended up at Washington and Lee and ultimately Medical College of Virginia for his pharmacy degree, I related to him because I have a little bit of that streak, not as much as his, but a little bit of that streak. So I was really more interested in trying to understand this man as he wrote home to his mother and to his sisters and to his stepbrothers. What was going through his mind? What kind of man was he? What philosophically, how did he think? How did he process? Physically, what was he like? Emotionally, what was he like? And to me, these letters just brought all of that to life for a man that I never knew. So I had a fabulous time going through these, transcribing them, and in the process, understanding a lot more about history of that day and age that we don't have a clue about.
It's interesting, too, that he was born and raised in Wilmington. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the characters in his letters that show up are names we recognize today.
Certainly. When he entered, a lot of his friends entered with him. Hoagy Hargrove Bellamy was one of his best friends. Duddy Douglas Taylor was one of his best friends. And they all just went in together. This was kind of a patriotic fervor that was taking place in the summer of 1917. And these young men just felt it was their duty. One of the letters that he wrote early on, once he got to Camp Sevier on September 1st, within a couple of days, he wrote a letter that says, "I believe that practically all the men are now in the Army because they felt it was their duty to be there and wouldn't be anywhere else, even if they could, and that they looked upon death as a noble cause, not a thing to be desired, because a dead soldier is of no service, but as a death to be preferred to any other." And all of a sudden, I'm starting to understand his patriotism, his understanding of where he fits with this group.
And this patriotism comes throughout this 2-year span for the most part.
It does.
I mean, he even at certain points talks about the barbarism of war, and yet he expresses this exhilaration.
Yes.
About it.
Yeah. That to me was every time he'd go through a harrowing experience, a description of something that you would just try to understand, how did he survive that? He writes at the end of the letter, "I have never been more alive. I've never been more engaged." And he always had that optimism at the end of the letters. But it was interesting how he portrayed the training in Camp Sevier. There may be one that would be appropriate that talks about the making of a soldier. And
this is the one, the metamorphosis of naturally peace-loving men.
Exactly.
Yeah, would you read some of that for us?
I'd be happy to. This was a letter to his mother written October 16, 1917. "Does it not seem marvelous to you that a race of men as naturally peace-loving and gentle as the average American can be, in the short space of a year or so, be changed into an orderly and wonderfully disciplined body of bloodthirsty and barbarous fighters? The one thought that is daily drilled into and hammered into us is that we must fight the Huns at their own game, that we must transform ourselves into such semi-humans, as I've mentioned, that we must awake in ourselves that primitive strain of barbarism and bloodthirstiness, which I suppose is present to a greater or lesser degree in every man's makeup. And above all, we are taught to hate the Hun with all the intensity that we can summon, and never to give him quarter, but to kill until the last one is down. It's really a metamorphosis almost too marvelous to realize, yet one can see the gradual change that's taking place in these men. They go through their bayonet trainings and their rifle exercises with a pep and a fire in their eyes that you can't realize unless you saw these same men 6 weeks ago."
How do you feel reading that? Because he does seem enlivened in a way by finding this primitive part of himself that he calls semi-human.
He does, and he talks about it as he gets into the trenches of Belgium and France, where all of a sudden it's not killing a human being; it's exterminating something that's far worse than that, something that's subhuman. And
he even takes a trophy at one point from a German prisoner.
He takes an epaulet from his shoulder. Yes.
How do you feel reading? I mean, do you relate to that? Could you see yourself in that position and find that barbarism in yourself?
I have a hard time getting there. I mean, I'm 70 years old, so I've been through a lot of in my own life, and I would have a I have a hard time understanding how that can be inculcated in the thought process of a young man. Be difficult to inculcate it in a 70-year-old man, maybe not so much in a more open-minded 22, 21, 24-year-old who might be amenable to that type of training.
He talks about learning to shout that they clean their bayonets with Germans.
Yeah, clean their bayonets with German blood. That's what they talk about in the training camps. But that training camp was a precursor to some of the extreme conditions that they ran into in Belgium and France.
Which we are
we'll come back to that
get
in just
to. Yes, okay. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. Today we're exploring letters home from a Wilmington man who served in the trenches during World War I. His grandson, Ed Hawfield, has compiled his letters, giving us a local window, into the Great War. When we come back from this break, we'll hear from some listeners, and you can call us on this Thursday using the phone number 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, Ed Hawfield is with us with a compilation of more than 150 letters from his grandfather, Edward Manning Hardin, written to his family in Wilmington between 1917 and 1919 during World War I. And we want to hear from you on this Thursday. Is there a tale that you've heard from family members who came before you about the Great War? How do you plan to preserve those family historical details? You can call us and tell us about it on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Ed Hawfield, I want to back up just a little bit. We've talked about Edward's patriotism, and this was a patriotism that he seemed to share with his contemporaries, that just wasn't questioned. Mm-hmm. They signed up in 1917. What was going on then that made Edward Hardin say, "Today's the day"?
You know, I don't know, but it certainly seemed to be a kind of a swell of patriotism for a lot of young men at that time. And I'm not sure what prompted it, other than the war had now been going on for 3 years in Europe. I think a lot of these young men felt like they could help, and nobody was making that happen. So I think when finally war was declared in the U.S., April 6, 1917, it sparked a lot of thought amongst these young men about how could we serve? How could we help the cause that's going on and that's ravaging the European front at this point? But it certainly it took hold of them when there was one break that they took going into Greenville, South Carolina, and they were a couple of soldiers were walking down the street with my grandfather, and some man made some disparaging remark about Woodrow Wilson, said something about the president shouldn't have done this, and they jumped on him and beat him up, and it's like
they beat this guy up
yes
because he disagreed with
because he
the
said
US
something derogatory about the president, and about being in the war. So that just, you know, is a small example of how much the fervor, this patriotic fervor, was instilled in them.
And there was no shame when your grandfather is describing this in his letter.
No,
I mean, he's writing this home to a family member.
Yeah, this is a statement of fact.
And he's kind of proud of it.
It is. I find it interesting that he wrote probably 65% of his letters to his mother. And here's a young man, bachelor, living at home. Many of you could probably relate to that. But living at home, working in his dad's business before he left to go overseas. And he had not even met my grandmother at this time. So the letters were about his girlfriends, about people that would say hi to the Bellamys, say hi to other friends and neighbors, and please, you know, Dad, here's some comments about how you can manage your pharmacy better, these kind of things, because he's now a brilliant young pharmacist graduate. But I also find the humor that comes through these letters. It's not so much the seriousness of the patriotism, but there's humor. He wrote to his mother 6 weeks after he got to Camp Sevier that he said, "I do wish that all of you could see our camp. It is a marvel of cleanliness. You can't find a speck of dirt in the tents, and the cots are always made up just so, nor can you find a piece of paper or trash of any kind anywhere around the camp. I've come to the conclusion that a man that has been a soldier will make the best husband a girl can have, because he knows how to do everything from building a fire at daybreak in the morning to building a house." So, you know, he's telling his mother that, you know, nobody could do better than to have someone like me as their husband, because I can do everything. I've been there, done that.
You're listening to Coastline. Today we're learning about the experience of war through the eyes of a 20-something Wilmington man who signed up in 1917 to serve in World War I. He sent more than 150 letters home to his family in Wilmington, and his grandson, Edward Hawfield, has compiled and transcribed those letters to give us a portal into Edward Hardin's experience 100 years ago. You can ask Ed Hawfield your own question on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1133 or by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Jason, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, ma'am. Thank you for having me. I was calling in to make sure your guests, as well as all the listeners, are aware of the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress. This is a project that started back in the early 2000s, and it was designed to collect exactly this type of material from your guests, including personal narratives, interviews, and definitely letters home, just like the gentleman has. So I was wanting to make sure he was aware of that and everyone else is aware of how important that project is at the Library of Congress.
And is there a particular person at the Library of Congress that he should ask about archiving his letters?
Well, there is a website, loc.gov/vets, and he can go there. And there's a contact page where they can call in or send an email. I'm not sure who is still working there. I actually worked there in the early 2000s when the project started, so I'm not sure who is still there. But they can just go to the website, and there's a contact page right there.
Jason, thank you for that. With something like this, the challenge is half of the material is about Wilmingtonians and what was going on here in Wilmington and the artifacts that he left behind that I now have. And the question is, where is the best home for something like this? Would it be locally because of so much local history, or would it be Library of Congress, or would it be to the World War I Museum? And I can't remember whether it's St. Louis or Kansas City, but one of them as well. So I'm wrestling with that right now because I don't have children, so I'm not sure where this treasure trove of information is going to end up.
Well, I would say there's no reason why you can't do all of them. Most of their records are digital now, so I wouldn't necessarily say you'd have to give up the originals, but even a digital copy of the transcription, you can scan in the original documents, which you can do as well.
Yep.
All right.
So, I mean, there's definitely plenty of options.
Jason, thank you so much for that. That really good idea. I appreciate the consideration there. Let's go back to Camp Sevier, South Carolina. As you said, Edward Hardin had a pretty robust sense of humor, but he also had to suffer through a lot before he even shipped out as Lieutenant Hardin. and he talks about the brutal winter of 1917. And to be really honest, I need you to contextualize this, because when I heard that, I thought, oh, come on, it's South Carolina, not the South Pole. But why? It was brutal.
It was
brutal.
Tell
us about that.
One of his earlier letters on October 25th, so here we are, kind of, you know, you think kind of cool fall weather, October 25th, his letter to his father says, "This morning we had to break the ice on the water bucket at the end of the tent before we could wash up." So here we are in October, and the water bucket has frozen at the end of his tent. He writes later that on January 4th, "The weather continues horribly here. All the snow and ice thaws during the middle of the day, and the whole camp is just a bed of mud 3 to 4 inches deep, and then it freezes again overnight, and so on every day until I am thoroughly sick of South Carolina." So, and now he's saying it's snowing again tonight. I suppose there'll be another 3 to 4 inches of snow on the ground in the morning, and I'll have to break the ice on the water bucket and in the morning to shave and wash, and it's next to impossible to do either satisfactorily with ice water.
Oh, and this is an unusually cold winter for South Carolina.
It is.
There comes a point when measles and meningitis sweep through his training camp, and he's still in training camp, hasn't even shipped out yet. He talks about 7 or 8 deaths a day from these outbreaks. So he's already grappling with his compatriots passing away.
He is. And his letter in late November basically talks to the quarantine because of the epidemic of measles and spinal meningitis. And as you said, 7 to 8 deaths a day. And besides that, he said there are another 4 or 5 deaths a day in the field hospitals from pneumonia. So he's already getting a flavor of what might go on without any gunshots, without any mortars, without any bombs. And he's starting to lose. I don't know if he lost any. I don't think he lost any friends that he knew at that time, but he certainly knew of the deaths that were going on in the camp. And remember, they didn't have barracks as they do today. This was a total tent city. So every place, the only hard facilities they had were the canteen, the mess hall, that type of thing, and some of the camp offices. But otherwise, these young men all slept in tents, 6 to a tent, 8 to a tent. So you can imagine, one of his letters, he says, it's -7 degrees, and the wind is blowing, and the flaps are going back and forth, and we're just trying to stay. And on top of that, the electricity went out. So we've got this flickering candle as these gales blow through the tent at 7 degrees below zero, and mom and dad, I don't know how I'll ever get warm again.
Yeah, and he undergoes quarantine himself at one point. He is absolutely miserable, and he writes, and this is an indication of these moments when his language is so evocative. Indigo, he writes, would appear a pale baby blue in comparison to my feelings this morning. And he had to quarantine with 5 big raw-boned country bumpkins with whom I have absolutely nothing in common and who are thoroughly incongenial. So a little bit of a snob, or?
Oh, I think he was a little bit of a snob. He grew up in Wilmington surrounded by people that really went to Wrightsville Beach routinely. That was the only beach to go to, of course, from these young men. And I think he did have some snobbery in him. And anybody that was country was probably not up to his level. But, finally the quarantine let up, and he wrote to his sister, it let up. This was December the 8th, 1917, where he said, the quarantine let up yesterday for the first time in 21 days. And, of course, I immediately lit out for town. Believe me, it was a relief to get away from this old place once more. I felt very much as I imagine a man feels after being released from a long stay in jail.
Does he ever get sick? He has a scare at one point, doesn't he, when he thinks he might have meningitis or mumps or measles?
He did, but it seemed to have passed fairly quickly, so he realized that he wasn't one of those that were unfortunate. But the winter continued to the point that when he wrote his mother in mid-January, he said, "You'll have to pardon the pencil, for my fountain pen and bottle of ink both froze during the night." So, you know, remember, this is a time where there were no ballpoint pens. You had your fountain pen that you drew up India ink into your pen and you wrote, unless your ink froze, and then you used a pencil.
And it's interesting, too, that during this time when he's watching these deaths occur from pneumonia and meningitis and measles around him in the training camp in South Carolina. And first of all, he's funny, even in his misery. At one point, he writes, "Life is just one damn thing after another," which sounds like our own George Scheibner here. And he also, because of his family's pharmaceutical background, is able to ask his father for medicine that he doesn't have access to in the training camp.
Exactly. And maybe a little knowledge is not so healthy. But, you know, he does get over it. He talks about taking a break. Finally, the quarantine is let up. He is able to go to Greenville, and he said, "Having been paid Thursday and feeling rather rambunctious after 10 days of not leaving the company street, I decided it was due for a first-class tub bath, a pair of sheets, and a couple of real meals, so I descended upon Greenville like a millionaire with a whole month's salary, the magnificent sum of $26.40, and put up at the Imperial Hotel very much after the manner of a millionaire."
We heard Sandy from Wilmington called in, and she says, "I'm elated to hear about Ed's project. I did this with my father's letters home from Vietnam." But she says, "I disagree that there isn't as much information out there about World War I. It seems as though my father's letters couldn't be as detailed as your grandfather's." She says, "I feel that 99% of Vietnam vets do not want to discuss anything about this war." And, you know, Ed Hoffield, that's a really interesting point, because we've talked about the fact that he, as we ship out overseas with him and get into the actual war experience, he doesn't shy away from telling his family members about the gore and the destruction and the misery. And yet, you might think that you'd want to shelter your loved ones who are already worried about whether you're going to live through this, but he doesn't.
He doesn't. And I'm part of the reason I'm so enamored with these letters is how detailed he becomes in areas that I just talked to a lady over the weekend whose father was in World War I. And she said she didn't even know he was in World War I until after he died and after her mother died, and they went through the house and found his photo. When he came home from World War I, he never talked about it. He never allowed the family to talk about it. And even after his death, his wife never talked about it to the children. So I find this a remarkable open attitude, and again, to his mother. It's not to his wife. It's to his mother, explaining some of these horrors that he goes through. You just learn so much of history with this. I never realized that when you became an officer, you had to pay for all of your stuff. There was a letter he wrote home saying, "I'm glad I'm an officer because that means, you know, they wash my dishes and I don't have to clean up my tent and all of that. But on the downside, I have to pay my board, buy my clothes and equipment, my own tent, and every little thing that used to be furnished to me as an enlisted man." I never knew that. So here's some fascinating history of what was going on as a soldier during that time, which is not the case today, but it certainly was in 1917.
Martin from Oak Island says, "My neighbor from Charlotte related a story from his family, the World War I training camp in Charlotte, North Carolina, Camp Green, when Spanish flu came. The bodies were stacked like cordwood," he says, "a disturbing sight." And Anne writes, "This topic is dear to me because I've been to the trenches of Ypres to honor my grandfather, who lied about his age. He was only 17 to fight for the Canadian Army at the outset of World War I. He was injured by shrapnel and gas and came back a broken man." Anne writes, "I remember the Canadian government sending my grandmother cards each Armistice Day with the Flanders Field red poppy and the poem about war. I read in our Going Green magazine that the NCDOT plants red poppies along the interstate last year to honor the sacrifice of North Carolina World War I vets. With the death of John McCain and the 100-year anniversary of World War I, good time to reflect on how extreme nationalism can lead to such destruction. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ed, for sharing these amazing letters of your grandfather, and that's Anne Marchino. Thank you, Anne, for that. Allison asks, is there a place we can read the letters to? Tell us where these letters are going. What's happening with them now, Ed?
That's a good question. this is only the second time this information has been shared. I did a presentation to the Cape Fear Museum several months ago with this, and I still wrestle with, should I publish these? Should they be available to anyone and everyone? And I've talked to UNCW, to the Special Collections Room, about putting these there so that they're accessible to anyone who wants to read them. And I think at the very least, as Jason had mentioned earlier, they can be a PDF file or a copy here in UNCW Special Collections Room or at the Library of Congress. I just haven't gotten that far yet.
He finally learns in April of 1918 that he's going to ship out. And this is a sort of deeper examination of his life and the possibility of his death. I wonder, we might need to save the reading of that letter for when we come back from the next break, but can you just kind of set this up? Where is he at this point?
Yeah, at this point, he knows he's shipping out, and he wants to tell his father that he is proud of what is where he's going. And he doesn't know whether he's coming back or not, but he wants the family to know that this is the right thing for him.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. Letters home from a South Carolina military training camp, and then the trenches during World War I, courtesy of Edward Manning Hardin's grandson, Edward Hoffield. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org with your own question or your own family history. When we come back from this short break, we'll have one more segment for you to get that in. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we're on a detailed and often wrenching journey into the World War I experience of Edward Hardin, who went from the privilege of Wilmington's upper middle class to confront pain, suffering, death, and the best and worst of the human spirit during wartime. His grandson, Edward Hoffield, has compiled and transcribed more than 150 letters sent to family members between 1917 and 1919. You can ask your own question about this vet's World War I experience, or tell us what you've heard from a family member as the centennial of the Great War approaches. Call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can email us at coastline@whqr.org. It's the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. And Ed, just before we went to break, you were setting up this letter you're about to read. April 1918, Edward Hardin gets word that he'll be shipping out as Lieutenant Hardin, and he begins a pretty deep examination of the possibility of his death.
Yeah, he writes to his father, April 21st, 1918. "Father dear, I am the victim of several conflicting emotions this morning. I think you know that I want to go, want to do my duty, and still there's a certain regret that leaving all my loved ones, possibly for a long, long time, maybe forever, whether I shall come back to you or not is of course uncertain, but I want you all to look at it as I do, that it will be all right either way. If it is will that I shall not, you will know that when I went out with my face toward the foe, and no man ever had a more glorious cause to die for. And if I come back, which I, of course, hope and expect to do, I'll be a better and bigger man for having gone. It's hard, I know, Father of mine, to have to part, but you all must look at this in the light that you are doing your bit by giving to the cause of your country someone who is dear to you, and be proud of it instead of sorry. I know that you will, and that you will send me away with a smile.
Whew. Yeah. Where was he deployed? Where did he go?
He went from Camp Sevier. They took a train to New York City, where they spent 8 days, of which 4 was free to go into the city every afternoon, which he did. He saw Al Jolson in a play, along with several other celebrities of the time, whom I had no idea who they are and still don't. he was involved in fundraising. Margaret Bellamy was there in one
another
occasion.
Wilmingtonian.
Another Wilmingtonian who asked him to come on stage, and they raised $150,000 worth of war bond sales. So he had quite a great 4 days, and then they cut off all leave, and then on May 9th, they boarded a boat for Calais, France, and they spent 10 days on the boat, uneventful, and every day they had a one-page boat newsletter called The Hatchet, where they would give them all the baseball scores of the day, and they had these little Dear Abby kind of comment sections, and it was quite humorous to go through these. We don't have time, as you know, but again, these are all collected. They saved all 10 of the letters.
And now I can see having an archive of these letters from training camp. But once he goes overseas and he's actually at war, does it become dangerous? What if some of these letters describing his circumstances fall into enemy hands? I mean, what are the limitations on him?
Well, it's interesting. The first letter he writes when he gets to Calais, France, is somewhere in France, some date in May. And he was not allowed to say where or when. The people who basically make sure that nothing gets out that shouldn't, if they find things in the letter that they think compromise any troop movements or dates of movements, then they will cut them out of the letter. There was only one letter that he must have said something about troop movements because it was cut out. But there was another letter that he wrote that had black ink markings all the way through about a page. And I thought, well, that's unusual. I'm wondering why they didn't cut that out of the letter. And I was able to hold it up to a strong light, and I realized he was talking about girlfriends. And no, Mom, I'm not engaged to so-and-so. I'll explain it when I get home. And it turns out that after he got back, my grandmother went through all the letters, and she censored the letters.
His wife. She said, we don't need a record of his past flames.
Not this with Stella LeBeau, let me tell you that. I mean, what a name. That's a great name, isn't it?
LeBeau. That sounds like a pinup girl's name or a former movie star's name.
So they did land in Calais, and that's when their official combination with the British troops became effective, and they became part of the American Expeditionary Force.
And at certain points, there's a field service postcard. Tell us how that becomes some of his correspondence and what that is.
Yeah, the field service postcard was a pre-printed card that allowed for a soldier to basically check or scratch through things that were appropriate or inappropriate. For example, it would say, I am fine, I am in the hospital, I am wounded, and you could scratch through. You could not add anything to it other than, I received your letter dated X, I received a parcel dated X, you signed it and dated it.
So the family knows
you're
he's
okay.
Still alive.
And I think this was primarily meant for men that did not write as extensively as my grandfather did. His pages were 8, 10, 12 pages long. I think this was for a lot of people who had no time or who were not particularly literate or did not just feel the need to write home. And so they would just check these boxes, and the Army provided these free of charge to people to communicate with their families that they were okay.
And we get our first real visceral description of the war when he's 24, 25 years old, comes with his letter on July 20th, 1918. I don't know if you have that one, but there...
I do. About
you do.
The getting used to the shells.
Never before have I imagined what war really was.
This was to his father on July 20th, where he talks about now there's never a minute a day or night that the big guns are not roaring on all sides and shells singing overhead and shrapnel bursting all around and maybe dropping within 50 to 100 feet away and jarring the ground like an earthquake. And then when they explode, the bits humming and singing around one's head like swarms of bees. The noise that these shells make is the most indescribable, terrifying a sound I have ever heard. You can hear way off in the distance a faint hum which grows louder and louder as the shell approaches, and then suddenly rushing sound followed by a huge bang and the earth suddenly seeming to rise in a tremendous shower 50 or more feet tall. But the most wonderful thing is how quickly become used to it. After 2 days, I could tell by the hum of a shell whether it was going to hit in front or behind, whether it was shrapnel or high explosive. And the boys in my company have become so used to it that the only action they take when a bit of shell flies within a few feet of their heads is to look around and go, can I say that word on the air? Damn.
Yeah, you can say damn.
damn, that was close. But that was in 2 days. They get used to being in this incredible environment.
So that's July 20th.
Right.
By August 5th, just a few weeks later, he has a brush with death that rattles him deeply. And I don't know if we have that available. We can come back to that if necessary.
We do have that available, yes.
Okay.
He is writing to his mother, and he says on August 5th, I've had an experience tonight that I don't care to repeat anytime soon, for it was the narrowest escape from death I have ever had. Captain Giles and I were in a dugout getting some reports and were just about ready to start out on our nightly tour of our guns positions when we realized that the Boche was strafing all around our dugout. You see, we'd gotten so used to hearing shells burst all during the day and night that we pay no attention to them usually unless they come particularly close. When we looked outside, we found the shells were bursting first in front of and then behind and then to one side and then to the other of our hole in the ground. So we decided that this position was growing unhealthy and went back inside to put our coats on and move off to another place. We'd just gotten outside when this tremendous explosion knocked us both off our feet. Candle was blown out. The sheetrock on our roof rattled. The floor buckled and rocks and dirt rained down on us. I thought my last minute had come. Everything was in total darkness in our tiny hole, and when I reached out instinctively for my gas mask, it was covered with tomato ketchup, a bottle of which was sitting on a shelf in the dugout. My first thought was that the captain had been killed and that this was his blood on the mask.
Oh, that is just, once again, his sense of humor perhaps reasserts itself. He writes of a time, and I don't know where this falls chronologically. One of his friends and fellow soldiers is mortally wounded. And he writes, I could see at a glance that the poor fellow was done for. Both legs were broken, his left hand shot almost entirely away, and an awful wound in his abdomen. But he was lying there, partially conscious, with not a word of complaint, his only thought being for his men, for he continually asked if they had been attended to. And this seems to be part of his real metamorphosis into understanding the gravity. You know, it's such a stark contrast from the kill, kill, kill in the training camp.
To hear one of his best, he says, he's a mighty good pal of mine. No man ever had a stauncher friend or a truer one. And he was a most efficient officer, generous and kind to a fault, loving his men and being in turn loved and respected by them. And this is David Loring, who died, and he is buried in France.
There's also a powerful letter about the dehumanizing nature of war. He's been in France at this point since April, 4 or 5 months, and he's ruminating on the meaning of the sound of the shells hitting. We actually talking about the bang of high-intensity shells. I guess he writes about that a few times. I want to get to Bry's comment. He says, wonderful guest you have on today. He says, my grandfather served in the Korean War, greatly affected by that war. I was wondering if Edward's grandfather ever addressed having issues dealing with the horrors of war, such as alcoholism.
I don't know. I don't know whether... I don't believe there was alcoholism when he came back. But clearly the horrors of this, and we can get to that in a little bit.
Well, you can tell us now, actually. He had something of a tragic end.
He did. He came back from the war. He met my grandmother. They dated, got married in 1920, and he started a young family. My mother was first in 1921, a younger sister, Mary Larston, in 23, and Helen in October of 1929, 2 weeks before the great crash of Wall Street. He had started a pharmacy franchising business here in Wilmington. He had three pharmacies going. He had overextended. And when the crash took place, he lost a pharmacy, he lost his house, and they had to move in with his in-laws. 6 months after that, he took his life.
Do you know if what we now think of as PTSD, would that have contributed?
I can't believe it did not contribute. To read these letters and what he went through, and then you dump on top of that, I've lost my family, I've lost my house, I've moved in with my wife's family, I can't support them the way I should. If you threw that on top of PTSD, which they didn't even, I mean, they knew about shell shock then, but I can't imagine that that did not play into his decision to take his life April the 15th, 1930.
Joel from Wilmington says, I'm a former Coast Guard. My grandfather participated in World War I, father in World War II. My experience, he says, is that anyone who participates in battle will not talk about it. It is not common for people to speak or tell about their war exploits. Another extraordinary element of what your grandfather did.
And I doubt that he did talk much about it after he got home. I think all of his talking was done with pencil and paper. Or pen and paper if it wasn't frozen. But that was the way he talked about it, and I think that was in some ways cathartic for him as he went through the trenches of France and Belgium and through the winter in Camp Sevier. But I think that was kind of his catharsis. It was his way of kind of getting it out.
Will you be doing another presentation with these letters from your grandfather?
As a matter of fact, I have one scheduled for the Senior Men's Club on September the 7th at 10 a.m. At the Cameron Art Museum. I've also decided that I was going to introduce this to other areas of Wilmington if they were interested in hearing about this.
He writes of a time in his letters when the Germans are starting to surrender. Do you have that readily available? Can you tell us what he's witnessing? Because he's in the trenches at this point. How does he know that this is happening?
Do you have the date of that?
I don't have the date of it. And this is the awkward thing about having 150-plus letters.
Exactly.
What? You don't have all of them memorized and cataloged?
No, I don't have that. But there are a couple of other things that I think were interesting. As many Wilmingtonians know the name Arthur Bleedenthal. Arthur was a good friend of my grandfather's. They would go on outings together, and his nickname was Bluey. Bluey Bleedenthal. And in June of 1918, when he was overseas, he says, Hoggy, who was Hargrove Bellamy, has just come in and told me of Bluey's death. I was so distressed. Good old Bluey, there's just one more score I have to settle with those damned Huns, and you can bet your bottom dollar my machine guns will get their share of the Bosch, and then a whole lot more. Father of mine, I believe that I am fast becoming a barbarian myself, for I find myself very often just longing for a crack at Fritz. So here's one more example of him believing that he is turning into a bit of a barbarian himself.
Edward Hoffield, that's this edition of Coastline. Thank you so much for sharing those letters of your grandfather with us today.
Thank you for allowing me to be here. It's been great. Thank you, Rachel.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager, Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the WHQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.